It is such a fantastic time in the hobby of tabletop role-playing games. And we're going to talk about a lot of really awesome stuff that happened this past week. We're going to talk about Wizards of the Coast announcing the release of the 5.2 SRD with the 2024 D&D rules being released in the Creative Commons later this year. We're going to talk about Black Flag, Kobold Press putting out their Tales of the Valiant system reference document, also under an open license. We're going to talk a little bit about Kobold Press's Tales of the Valiant, which has hit our, for those of us who backed the Kickstarter, actually got the documents for it. We're going to talk about the Oracle Monster Generator, a new Kickstarter that is being done by Nord Games. We're going to talk about the 13th Age version 2 Kickstarter, which is also going on right now. There's some, let's see. I have a couple of interesting articles that we're going to look at today, including 9 perfect things for a D&D game and why cults are awesome in RPGs. Today's main topic is going to be why open gaming licenses matter to GMs. As a game master, as just somebody who wants to run games at your table, why should you care about whether or not games have open licenses or not? We're going to talk about that today. And we're going to cover the first batch of questions from the May 2024 Patreon Q&A, all today on the Lazy RPG Talk Show. I'm Mike Shea, your pal from Sly Flourish, here to talk about all things in tabletop role-playing games. This show is brought to you by the patrons of Sly Flourish. Patrons get access to the awesome Lazy DM Discord community where we can all chat throughout the week about everything that's been going on in our hobby and offering tips and tricks and workshops for how to make our games better. It's a fantastic community, such awesome people. You also get access to a bunch of tools to help you run your games. You get access to exclusive adventures, previews of upcoming products, tons of stuff that you get to help you actually run your games. And you help me put on shows like this. To the patrons of Sly Flourish, thank you so much for your outstanding support. So, Wizards of the Coast. This is a big, sparky candle. Is it lit yet? It's probably not lit yet because it's not in hand, but they have committed to releasing. They posted this 6 days ago. They have committed to releasing the 2024 core rules in a new 5.2 system reference document. For some of you, you're like, what did you just say? What the hell is that? So, 5th edition of D&D actually exists, the rules for 5th edition D&D, the rules and a lot of the mechanics for it exist in a thing known as the 5.1 SRD. This is a document that you can download for free under a Creative Commons license, and that means that you can write products that use all of the rules that are being developed for, that have been developed for the 5th edition of D&D. There was a big question about whether or not Wizards was going to release another system reference document for the updates that they are doing this year and early next year, i.e. new monsters, new spells, revised spells, revised monsters, revised magic items, all that kind of stuff. We didn't know what they were going to do. There were some questions about whether they're going to do it. They were kind of waffling on the language. Well, they did not waffle on this language. They specifically said they offered a date. They offered exactly what they're going to put in there. And they said, we are going to be updating the 5.2 SRD from 5.1, modernizing the content for the 2024 rules revisions. It's a massive update. It'll provide revised rules at the same scope. That probably means you're not going to get all the subclasses that exist. And I don't know what they're going to necessarily do with feats, because feats aren't part of the 5.2 SRD either. And they're going to release it under a Creative Commons Creative Commons attribution license, known as a CC BY license. This means that you can use it for pretty much anything that you want to, with almost no restrictions, other than you have to reference the fact that you use this system reference document to do it, which is usually like one sentence that you can include in the beginning. This is outstanding news. They say that they are going to do this after the Monster Manual is released, the next revised Monster Manual, in February. I heard elsewhere that they said it was specifically aimed at the end of February. So that is fantastic. We are going to be able to see this stuff updated in 5.2. They have made a commitment to it. They were very clear about their commitment to it. There's not a lot of waffly words in here. I think it's outstanding, and I'm very happy to see it. So that is just good news, period. Just absolutely good news, period. If you want to read the specifics of what they say, I'm going to link to it in the show notes and you can read it. But it is outstanding news that a 5.2 SRD updated with the rules from the 2024 updates to D&D are going to be available. And of course, that means the old one is still available. So that means we actually have two separate ones. We have the original one from 2014 and a new one from 2024. And they're separate from each other. So you can pick which one you want to use and which material you want to use from both. That is outstanding. The other thing they said in this, and this is a thing that had come up before, is they still have committed to releasing older versions of the SRD, which is really the 3.5 SRD from back in the early 2000s under a Creative Commons license as well. But they're not going to start working on that till they've done this one. All right. They said they were going to have it out late last year. They missed that deadline, but I can kind of understand what's going on, and I'm glad that they have still committed to releasing that. I don't think that's probably quite as vital as the new updated 5 rules, the new updated rules for 2024, but I definitely know people, I have friends who are developing systems that wanted to be built on that one, and they want it under a Creative Commons license. That one is still released under the OGL. It'd just be nice to not have to use the OGL, because we all know that the OGL's got issues. So that's outstanding. The same week that happened, Kobold Press released a brand new version 2 of the Black Flag system reference document. The Black Flag system reference document is all of the core rules and much of the material that they developed for Tales of the Valiant, which also was released this week, but we'll get into a minute. It is a huge document. The Black Flag reference document is a 385-page system reference document with character classes, lineage and heritage, backgrounds and talents, tons of stuff. Now, like the 5.1 SRD, it doesn't have all of the material from Tales of the Valiant in it. In fact, it has one subclass for every one of the classes instead of all of the subclasses that exist. And I did see some people that are kind of like, you know, why didn't it have everything? Like, you were supposed to be releasing everything under an open license. How come you're not releasing it under an open license? And the argument was because we don't want to put everything out there. We still want to have you to have a reason to buy Tales of the Valiant. If you want to build your own subclass, you have all of the things that you need in order to build a new subclass. If you want to build your own lineage and heritage, you can. If you want to build your own feats, you can. We're just not going to give everything away. That was the argument for it. But it is a huge document. And in particular, the thing that I look at and go, oh, wow, this is awesome, is they have tons and tons of monsters. So huge piles of monsters that are available in here. Nice bookmarked file. And this was our first chance to take a look at the full monster design of the monsters that we're going to see in Tales of the Valiant. But now we also have the Monster Vault from Tales of the Valiant. We're going to take a look at that. The nice thing is now those monsters are here. Now, one key consideration is the Black Flag SRD is not released under a Creative Commons license. It is released under the Orc license. Now, the difference is the Orc license is specifically developed for role-playing games. It was developed by Azora Law, who was funded by Paizo, the creators of Pathfinder, I think that's how it worked out. I'm pretty sure Pathfinder funded Azora Law to make the Orc license. It is a much more solid license than the OGL was, but it is what we refer to as a viral license. What that means is if you want to include stuff from the Black Flag SRD in your product, you have to use Orc. You can't say, unlike a Creative Commons attribution license where all you have to do is attribute it and then you can do it, you can release whatever you want, you can keep things back that you don't want to release. This one requires that all of the mechanics of your game is released under the same license, that you, if you are going to make a product based on the Black Flag SRD, you also need to use the Orc license, and any mechanics that are inside your product are also released under Orc automatically. You don't get to restrict them. What I think is particularly interesting about this is that Kobold Press themselves didn't have to use the Orc license in order to get the material from the 5.1 SRD, which means that they were able to limit the stuff that they released under Black Flag only because Wizards of the Coast did not use the Orc license. They used a less restrictive license. But Kobold Press says, however, if you want to use our stuff, you have to release all of yours. So it's kind of this weird hypocritical situation of saying, we decided to hold some of our mechanics back, but you can't. And I think that is a kind of a bummer. I would be much happier if the Black Flag system reference document was released under the same Creative Commons license that they used in order to write it in the first place. That seems like it would be fair. Still, we got lots of material for it. I think the limitations on what you can do with that license are less limited, particularly because you probably don't even need to use the Black Flag system reference document to make stuff compatible with Black Flag. If you do want to restrict some of your content, you don't want to release everything, you can still use Creative Commons and just reference back the original Creative Commons document, because that's where a lot of the stuff came from. So that is kind of interesting. It's the first situation I've seen like this. And understand, I love Kobold Press, right? I talk about their products all the time. I love Tales of the Valiant. I am one of the authors. I'm one of the designers on the Tales of the Valiant monster book. I designed the encounter building guidelines that are in Tales of the Valiant monster book. So I'm definitely with them, right? I love them. However, from a open gaming proponent and open gaming evangelist kind of guy, I kind of wish this was under Creative Commons instead of Orc. And I think it's kind of weird that they use a Creative Commons, limit their stuff, but then require that everyone else downstream from them has to release everything. Because if Wizards of the Coast had done that, they would have had to release everything. I think that's kind of interesting. Kobold Press did release Tales of the Valiant to backers. I don't know if it's available for sale yet on their website, and the physical books are not coming out, I think, for a couple of months. But we did get PDFs of it, and it is really cool. We got two books, big, great big books, 387 pages for the Player's Guide, and exactly 387 pages for the Monster Vault as well. I have not dug into both of these books super heavily yet. I'm very excited to have them. I, of course, am a monster dude. I'm a GM. I'm always looking for the GM stuff. So I kind of focus more on the Monster Vault. I think there's going to be a lot of people that are talking about what's in the Player's Guide. So keep an eye out for that. But I am definitely interested in the Monster Vault, and I love it. I think it is really, really good. In particular, I think the monster design that is going on here has made monsters that are easy to run and hit like freight trains. So if you are looking for tougher monsters, boy, this book is going to give it to you, because these monsters hit hard. They also simplified the design of the monsters a lot, and they're using some of the newer style of spellcasting monsters where their challenge rating is in their actions, not in their spells. There's a lot of monsters in here that have spellcasting options, and they can use one of their multi-attack to do their spellcasting options, so that definitely works. They have what I consider to be the best encounter building guidelines that has ever been written by any human being on the planet, because I wrote them. And talks, you know, if you're familiar with the Lazy Encounter Benchmark, you're going to see a version of the Lazy Encounter Benchmark in here. It has this table too. This is something that I was particularly proud of. A table where you can pick any number of PCs, go down the list, figure out what the average PC level is, and it tells you how many challenge ratings of monsters is on the hard side for a challenging encounter, what the minimum monster is that's going to offer any kind of challenge, and what's the maximum CR of a monster that where above which it might be too hard. I think that's a really handy table to have. That is a table that I do not have in anything else. And it's still based on the Lazy Encounter Benchmark, so you could kind of build a table like this yourself if you wanted to. But I'm very happy with it. I'm very proud of the encounter building guidelines that are inside of this book. Beautiful artwork. It looks just gorgeous. I was going through this book, and it's got that super vibrant art that Kobold Press is known for with all of their other monster books. What's really cool is, like, even if you're not interested in Tales of the Valiant as an alternative system, I think just having the Monster Vault alongside your other monsters is really good. I think these may be the best designed stat blocks for monsters, for the core monsters of 5th edition. They're definitely hard, though. And where I would worry is in that challenge rating 1 and 2 area. I think the CR1s and 2s are probably hitting too hard given the levels of the characters. But if your characters are 5th level and above, these monsters are really going to give them what for. So if you feel like monsters, and I have definitely felt like this, if you feel like monsters above a certain challenge rating are typically not hitting hard enough or not offering as much of a threat, you are definitely going to see a bigger threat with these monsters. The monster book itself has lots of things like which monsters are with other ones. This is kind of neat. It's got a pronunciation guide. I didn't know. I just noticed that for the first time. Yeah, you put that on your bingo card. Mike Shea complains about monster damage being too high. That's rare. One of the cool things it's got is like which monsters are likely to ally with other monsters. I think that is a really handy table to have. It does not have random encounter tables in this. I expect that's probably something you'll see in the GM's guide, but we also have random encounter tables in lots of different places. I've never seen one that has pronunciation. Apparently, I've been mispronouncing Balor. It should be Baylor all this time. Look at me being a dummy for the last 20, you know, last 30, 25 years. But let's take a look at like a monster. I'm going to pick like a really fun one where, you know, I dig it. I'm going to go right to the Lich because I love Liches. Right there. Two of them, the Lich and the Lich Virtuoso. First of all, look at that art, right? Like that is a Lich, like bang, it's exploding, his robes are going all over the place, right? It's just really, really, really cool stuff. The Lich stat block is big, but it's not just two. But look at that, CR21, 314 hit points. That's like three times higher than the one in the 5.1 SRD, that's in the 2014 Lich. Arcane Mastery, Legendary Resistance, all of that stuff. Multi-attack. The Lich uses his Lich's Gaze that makes 4 Arcane Death Burst attacks. Or it makes 3 Arcane Death Burst attacks and 1 Death-Infused Rod attack. It can replace 1 attack with use of spellcasting. Lots of options for you to change it around. Arcane Death Burst, again, CR21, plus 12 to hit, range 5 or 120 feet, 23 force damage plus 17 necrotic damage. That's 40 points of damage that it can do 4 times on its action. That's a lot of damage. 480, 120, that's 160 points of damage just on its turn. Then, of course, it has legendary actions where it can cast a spell for two actions. It can move without provoking opportunity attacks, or it can cast Disrupt Life, which does another 21 necrotic damage in a Great Big Area Burst. It's got a bunch of spells that it can cast alternatively, but right off the bat, you can see, like, oh, the Death Infused Rod does 21 bludgeoning damage plus 17 necrotic damage, and the target must succeed on DC 20 con save or be paralyzed for a minute. Make save at the end of turns. Really strong lich, and not, I look at this lich and I'm like, this is not particularly hard to run. Like, I think I might have an easier time running this lich than something else. It still has the lair actions too, similar lair actions to what we saw in other ones. So I'm very happy with the monsters that I am seeing inside the monster vault. I think even if you decide that you don't want to, like, switch over from one, you know, whatever version of 5e you like to another one, just having the monster vault along with your other monster books is probably a really good deal. I'm not yet ready to say whether or not I like this book better than the Monstrous Menagerie by Level Up Advanced 5e, which has been my favorite book of core monsters for a long time. My immediate gut reaction is telling me that I like the stat blocks better for this, but I think the Menagerie still has some extra stuff that it throws in its monster descriptions that I don't see here. So it's kind of a hard situation. I don't think you're going wrong with either of them, but I do think that the stat blocks that are available in the Monster Vault are excellent. If you want to try those stat blocks, if you want to see what they're like, you can, of course, get the Black Flag SRD because the monster stat blocks are in there, and try them out and see what you find. Nord Games. I'm a good friend of Nord Games. I've talked about their stuff before, and they have on BackerKit a new campaign for the Oracle Monster Generator. They have other generators as well. They have, like, a story generator and a character generator that they've built, which is a stack of cards with really good artwork that you can flip over, and there's, like, different tables that you can use to sort of combine together to build new things. This is a system-agnostic monster generator, so you are not building stats with these monsters. You are instead building themes and ideas for your monsters by mixing them together. This actually works really, really well side by side with my own book, Forge of Foes, because Forge of Foes is very much about mechanics and style and powers and things that you would apply to a monster. So this one gives you the ideas to build monsters. The other one gives you the stats to wrap around them. And I think these two products together are really, really excellent. I backed this Kickstarter. I'm excited to see the results. So they have a lot of different examples of the kind of artwork that you're going to see, the kind of stats, you know, the description of what you're going to see, how it all works. You can back it both at the PDF and the physical tier. The physical tier, you actually get a box set that includes 420 of these cards that you can mix together. $50 for the box set, or $62 if you can get the box set with the PDF together. Kind of neat. I actually backed the PDF of this. I'm excited to kind of have a digital version of it, but my room is getting full of everything else. But really looks cool. And of course, you can back and get the story generator and the character generator along with it. Fantastic product, beautiful artwork. I highly recommend it. Check out their backer kit in the show notes. I have talked a lot about 13th Age in the past. I love 13th Age. It is an excellent system, excellent D20 based system. They have the second edition of 13th Age that's coming in now. It's going to be two books, a GM book and a player book, modifications of the original 13th Age. I've talked a lot about the 13th Age bundles of holding and humble bundles, which have come out in recent days. The nice thing is that all of those remain compatible with what's going on in this one. I haven't dug into it too much because I kind of want to just get it when it's done. So I haven't really spent a lot of time saying, oh, what's changed and how they fixing things, but I'm really excited for it. I back the physical tier. I definitely want to get the books of this, and I am very excited to play it because, boy, my players really love 13th Age. 13th Age is like the polar opposite of Shadowdark. On one side, you have super grim and gritty, super deadly, and the other one, you have like super heroic fantasy. 13th Age is definitely a super heroic fantasy RPG. I adore it. I think it's really, really fun, and I'm definitely excited to pick it up. So please check out the Pelgrane Press 13th Age 2nd Edition Kickstarter, which is going on right now. Link to that is also in the show notes. I ran across two different articles that I thought were really excellent articles. I've been spending a lot more time kind of reading blogs and enjoying my time with blogs. And two articles that I saw this week, both of them that you will find links to in the show notes. One of them was 9 Perfect Things for a D&D Game, which I thought was a really good kind of way to think about what an ideal game looks like. I've talked about this on Sly Flourish before. When you have a game, what does it look like? And the reason why it's nice to identify the criteria for a perfect game is it gives you an idea of what you need to do in order to make your game perfect, or at least close to perfect. And so this was written by Scroll for Initiative. Again, you can find a link in the show notes. You can subscribe to them on an RSS feed. They have an email newsletter that you can subscribe to as well. And some good thoughts. Regular game, a strong start, very nicely refers to my discussion about a strong start. Having a sense of freedom, decisions that matter, not having too much combat, immersive descriptions, learning new things, a DM who cares about your character, and a DM that's on your side. I think these are excellent criteria. And as GMs, we can learn about this and say, are we bringing these things to the game that we're designing? You know what's not on here is dynamic lighting. Right? There's a lot of things that we do. You know what else isn't on here? Fancy Dwarven Forge terrain. A really solid, gridded battle map. Lots of things that aren't on this list that probably don't matter as much as we'd like to think. I think like a DM caring about your character, a DM who's on your side, immersive descriptions, you know, this idea of not too much combat is, I think, really interesting. Yeah, bespoke hand-painted miniatures are not on here as well. Regular game, that's an important one, right? Sense of freedom. So these are really good criteria. If you want to see a link to the whole article, check out the Scroll for Initiative article that's linked in the show notes. Another article that came around from Joe M and MT Black was, why cults are awesome for RPGs? I love cults. And I love cults for many of the reasons that are described in this. This is from the Against the Wicked City blog. And it talks about what makes cults a really good villains. Like, why do we like cults? And some of it is tradition. So here's some reasons why we like cults. Tradition. Evil cults have been a big part of D&D. And so, you know, we remember cults and it gives us a bit of nostalgia. Influence. Cultists are the default enemy in lots of areas because they can influence the world around them. They're very insidious in how they do that. Moral clarity. Cultists are usually almost always jerks. We're not picking on orcs for being orcs or, you know, troglodytes for being troglodytes. We're picking on cultists because they like to kill and eat people or whatever they like to do. You know, it's kind of fun to have cults where they are really crazy cults, but they really don't do anything bad. And then you're like, well, we don't worry about them. Like, they're just tree worshipers. What's wrong with tree worshiping? Trees is fine. It's when like, oh no, we worship trees, but we do so by leaving the bodies of villagers at their feet. Oh, well, that's a different story. So moral clarity is a good one. Dungeon friendliness, that, you know, cults often hang out in like ancient tombs or old hidden shrines like that. There's lots of good cult lairs that you can throw that fit well into dungeons. Appropriate scale, disproportionate influence. They are small enough that you can actually defeat them, but powerful enough that they can influence lots of things around you. That's neat. Easy excuse for magic and monsters, right? You can definitely have lots of different ways. This is, why can't the cult champion vomit rivers of boiling blood at his enemies? Because he's a cultist. Why can't the party wizard learn to do that? Because they haven't developed their life insanity to skullfang the planet Effer. That's probably not appropriate. So that's kind of fun. Scalability. You can have cults from first level to 20th level. We've seen cultists in lots of different systems all the way up to the top. Easy excuse for violence. You really hate them, so you don't feel bad killing cultists because they're usually very terrible people. They love MacGuffins. They love to have like weird artifacts that you have to recover or destroy, or idols that you have to smash, or powerful magic items that you need to acquire. Lots of good reasons. An easy excuse for a boss fight. Cultists always have a cult leader. We can always have fun with that. So cultists are really great. Fantastic article. I really enjoyed it, and I agree with everything in it, and I wanted to pass that along. For probably the past year and a half, there's been a lot more talk about open gaming licenses ever since the OGL issues that occurred at the beginning of 2023. But we're at a really fantastic time for open licenses for RPGs. Since then, many different publishers have put out open licenses of their games, and we've seen some of the biggest companies also putting out open licenses of their games. Just this past week, Wizards of the Coast announced that they are going to be updating their system reference document with all of the work that they've been doing for the 2024 edition of D&D. We already have the old one that was released under Creative Commons last year. EN World Publishing released a massive, like, 1,000 pages worth of material for Level Up Advanced 5e under an open gaming license. So we just had Kobold Press release the Black Flag system reference document, the material that they're using for Tales of the Valiant for 5e. So we have lots of different open gaming licenses. But why should you care? Why should you, as a game master, give a damn about whether or not a game is using an open license or not? I believe you should. I believe it actually matters quite a bit. And today, I'm going to talk to you about why I think it's important that we have games with open licenses and what that actually gives to us as game masters, not as publishers and producers, nothing like that. So there's lots of different kinds of open licenses, and there's lots of different games that have them. I'm not going to be covering them in this video. I'm not going to talk about all of the different ones you can get and what are the nuances of the license themselves and what matters. I'm going to talk more generally about why this can really help you and help the whole hobby as more games have open licenses for the systems that they're operating under. And a big one is that you're just going to get more products, that because there are open gaming licenses for different systems, you're going to see a lot of products that you can pick up. And in many cases, these products are the kinds of things that the core company that's making the game can't or won't publish themselves. So I'm going to be talking a lot about 5e, but we have tons and tons of stuff coming out for 5e that isn't coming out from Wizards of the Coast. Wizards of the Coast actually produces not a lot of different books for 5e. But there are hundreds to thousands of different books. I think there's just thousands, right, Mark? There are thousands of books released for 5th edition that are fully compatible with the 2014 version of D&D and very likely the 2024 edition of D&D that you can use. So you can find lots of different products to support very small niche kind of stuff. I've talked about like Uncharted Journeys a lot, an entire book that just talks about how to fill in the space and journeys that you're going on. There's tons and tons of monster books. Kobold Press released 4 different big monster books that expand upon the monsters that you typically find. We wouldn't have these if we didn't have an open gaming license. We might have a bunch of different kinds of RPGs. Everybody would be making their own kind of RPG, maybe, or they'd be kind of skirting the edge of what they're allowed to do under copyright and trademark law in order to make these books. But we don't have to worry about that because we have open gaming licenses. It gives publishers permission to do it. And it gives them fearless freedom to make these products. They don't have to worry about having a legal team on staff making sure they're not dancing too close to the intellectual property of the company that they are trying to support. Instead, the company has stated explicitly what they allow you to do and what material they give to you so that you can do that. And that means that for publishers, small publishers, independent publishers, one person can take these things and make products and put those products out there to support stuff. And we have seen some tremendous products that have come out of this. Shadow Dark, for example, very popular old school RPG, I love it and I adore it, is using the Creative Commons license that Wizards of the Coast used to release the 5.1 SRD. That meant that Kelsey Dione did not have to stray too far away from the core concepts of D&D because they said, you're allowed to. Here it is. Here's our declaration that you're allowed to. Here's the material you can use. And then she can modify it how she sees fit and make it part of Shadow Dark. So we wouldn't have games like Shadow Dark if we didn't have that. That's not exactly true, because you know, a lot of times companies can figure out how to go around it, but I've seen companies that have tried to make sure that they're staying further away from core material like the 5.1 SRD. Paizo did this, Level Up Advanced 5e did this, and it took a lot of effort and it took a lot of legal cost to make sure that they didn't dance too close to the kind of stuff that they were worried about doing. Back last year, when the OGL thing was going on, every publisher I talked to was worried about this, and many people scuttled entire projects. I've talked to publishers who say that their entire businesses had almost folded because of what was going on with that there was a lot of products that were not getting made ever since that had occurred. But now with the open licenses, individual producers can fearlessly produce products because they know that the companies that put that material out have explicitly stated that they can do that. That's great for us. That means we're going to see lots of products from lots of independent developers that can support really niche or really interesting ideas that we put into our games. A lot of times, these companies are making things that no one else would make. Really micro-focused things that just focus on one specific aspect of the game. We've seen things like 5e hardcore mode, where it just tweaks the rules of 5e in a way that makes it a harder version of D&D than you would typically have. People can do like 5-page supplements of just one subclass that they want to add for one thing. The other advantage that we get by having these open gaming licenses is that new systems can build off of old systems, that we can take the experiences of designers and developers who were funded from a company to make a game, and we can capitalize off of those experiences to make new versions and new games, either opinionated versions of the original game or entirely new versions of the game. The game Dolmenwood, very old school game built upon sort of European fantasy and European lore using a very old school system. But right at the bottom, we see that, they're using the system reference document from Wizards of the Coast, the 5.1 SRD in order to build their game. Could they have gotten away without it? Maybe, but now that was a bit tricky, and then that puts them at big risk, especially if they're doing big print runs and things like that. That's an issue. Instead, they get explicit permission to be able to do it, to build a system like this that's completely different than what D&D 5th edition is like. Different style, different format, different type of product completely, but they get to build off of the experiences and build off of the work that happened there. I actually have heard of this. Actually, I'm going to save that. Do I have the Ulysses Pact? Yes, I do have that in there. I want to talk about the Ulysses Pact. You know, I brought up Shadow Dark before, but Shadow Dark is the same thing, right? Somebody who had played and designed a lot of stuff for 5th edition, who had a style of game that she really enjoyed, that she thought she would bring into the world, ran a very successful Kickstarter for it, and built Shadow Dark, and was able to do so based on the bones of 5th edition, which were open and available for people to use. So that means that us as GMs, we get access to Dolmenwood, we get access to Shadow Dark, we get access to all of these products, products that are directly compatible with like the 5th edition of D&D, but also entirely different products that we get to build. That is why open licenses are important. Another major advantage for GMs that we get from open licenses is that we know that our game can continue to be supported regardless of what the company does. I've actually heard this. I was reading a Cory Doctorow article recently where he referred to this as the Ulysses Pact. Ulysses is the guy that's on his boat and he ties himself to the mast and he tells his crew to put wax in their ears. And then when the sirens sing, he is the only person that was able to hear the siren song. But because he's chained to the masthead, he can't do anything about it. And the idea for a Ulysses Pact for a company is when a company does something or puts something out or sets up a situation that means that even they can't go against it later. An example is Wizards of the Coast cannot revoke the 5.1 SRD under the Creative Commons license. It would be tremendously difficult for them to do so, and they would probably have massive, huge, multi-trillion dollar companies that would go after them for trying to break this thing because those companies use the same licenses for stuff that they put out. So we know that we are safe in supporting a particular system because we know that other people are going to be able to put it out there. And Wizards of the Coast should also feel good about this because the people that believe in an open license at Wizards of the Coast know that nobody can take it away from them either. This means that designers who work at Wizards of the Coast know that when they leave Wizards of the Coast for one reason or another, they can continue to develop for that game with all of the experience that they have because the license is available for them to use the same products that they were developing when they worked for the company. That's outstanding for them, but it's also outstanding for us as GMs because we know that our game is going to continue to be supported. I think I can safely say it is highly probable that 5th edition of D&D will continue to be supported until we're dead. Like at least our lifetimes. Somebody out there is going to continue to make stuff for it. It may not be forever, it may not be huge, but we see stuff that is still being developed for a game that's 50 years old. We're still seeing BX stuff that's coming out, stuff that's compatible with BX that's 50 years old. I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be available for another 50 years. And we have so many people that have now learned the game from the 5th edition of D&D that we know that whatever Wizards of the Coast decides to do, whatever way they go with the game, it doesn't matter because we know that somebody out there, including us, including somebody else, will continue to support the game that we love, the game that is out now. I think that is fantastic. This also counts for digital tools as well. Over the past few years, probably it's been, you know, probably 10 years, we've seen a lot of growth in digital tools for gaming. It really exploded during COVID. From the last time I polled people, the respondents, about 50% of the respondents were playing online. And many of the people that play in person are still using digital tools, even if they're playing games in person. They like to have these digital tools, whether they're character builders or ways to look up monsters, mapping tools, all different kinds of things. The more material is available from the company in the open, it means there's a wider range of tools that can use that stuff. The example is you can find many different tools, mobile applications on your phone, web-based applications, different VTTs that are using the material from the 5.1 SRD to give at least basic versions of characters that they can run and that they can operate. Now, it doesn't usually include all of the material that a company does. For example, only the core material for the 5th edition of D&D is available under a Creative Commons license. All of the other books are still proprietary to Wizards of the Coast, but it does mean that at least that core fundamental stuff can be built into just about any tool. It means that we can find tools all over the internet that have access to these kinds of materials and that we can use for our game. And again, whatever direction Wizards of the Coast or any other company decides to go with whatever material they have, we know that the core material is available out there. And if somebody wants to build a tool to support it, they can. They don't have to ask anybody's permission. Here's a big one for me. A lot of times there is a barrier to entry for new players in the game. We want players to come in and join our game, but they don't necessarily want to drop $50 or $60 on a player's guide for a book they may only run a couple of times. When you have an open game, when you have games that are on an open license, it means that you can send material to your players so they can understand what the game is like. The material may not be everything, it may not have everything that they want, but it almost certainly has enough that they can understand how to play the game. A lot of games coming from Evil Hat, for example, are released under Creative Commons licenses. There is a Blades in the Dark system reference document. There is a Fate system reference document. So there are many different systems that have their material out in an open license, and that means you as a GM are free to give that material to your players. An example in my own game is we are going to be running Level Up Advanced 5e for our next version of, for our next campaign. And instead of having to worry about like, oh, well, I can, you know, you can either buy the book directly or you can, I can share the PDF with you over Google Drive, but only if you can't download it and things like that. I can say, hey, here's the entire system reference document. You can download it. You can read it. You can read the rules for it. And they can download it however they want. They can also access it through an HTML format because people have made HTML versions for it. So it gives them a lot of access to material that they don't have to directly pay for. Now, that said, these are not replacements for the core books. The core books are still better. That it, I wouldn't want to give the impression that you can just play the whole game with nothing but SRDs. SRDs are pretty flavorless. They don't offer a lot of instruction. They don't actually help you walk through the game. They don't give you an understanding of what a subclass is or how it fits in the world. And that's the kind of material that I think it's perfectly fine for companies to keep inside their own intellectual property. And that people should, once they get an understanding for the game, once they realize they're going to play it, should go ahead and invest in buying a player's guide or should actually buy the product because it actually matters. Now, a lot of times the physical book is the thing you're going to buy because there isn't a Creative Commons version of a document that you can print. I mean, you can print it, but it would cost you a lot to print it. You might as well just buy the book. So physical books are obviously a really great way to get the actual material that's being given by a publisher. But just the idea that you can give people a taste of it, particularly if you're only running like a one-shot game and paying $50 or $60 for a core book in order to just play one game is probably a pretty hefty investment. But if you're going to play a long campaign, I would definitely reinforce to you as a GM and for you to reinforce to your players that you're better off actually buying the books if you plan to run for a long time. But I can completely understand if players don't want to invest in that right away, and system reference documents and open gaming license books are a really good way to get at least a basic understanding of what that game is going to be like before you fully invest in it. So there's a big advantage in that. So I think it's very reasonable for GMs, if they hear me talking about open gaming licenses, if they see news articles about tabletop role-playing games and gaming licenses and things like that, to kind of go like, what do I care? That's not actually helping me run my game. The reality is open gaming licenses are making the entire hobby better. It's giving lots of people freedom to build products. It's giving people lots of freedom to be able to expand upon systems, to build new systems that are built upon the experiences of others. It is expanding this entire hobby in tremendous directions, all different ways, from new games, new flavors of existing games, new products for existing games, new tools, new technologies, new ways of enjoying this hobby, a better accessibility, all kinds of ways that open gaming license are tremendously helpful to the TTRPG hobby. And I can't even express myself. I'm so excited. And really, we are in just such a fantastic time for that to be the case. As I mentioned, Wizards of the Coast already has the 2014 D&D rules out in the 5.1 SRD under a Creative Commons license. Level Up Advanced 5e has a 1,000-page system reference document for their system, independent version of 5e. Kobold Press just put out the Black Flag system reference document, and Wizards of the Coast themselves announced that the 2024 rules update to 5e is also going to be making its way into the Creative Commons. So we are seeing, and that's just for 5th edition, but we're seeing that across the board for many different systems and many different RPGs overall, and it's making the entire hobby stronger, it's making it better, we're seeing more material, and it's making this game a lot more fun to play. Every month on the Sly Flourish Patreon, we have a Patreon Q&A. Any patron of Sly Flourish can ask any RPG-related question. Every Friday, I go through every question, and then some of those questions make their way here to the show, or they become the catalyst for another article or a video in the future. And today, our first question is from Ryan. Ryan says, I feel my abilities of campaign complexity management caps out around the end of Tier 2. I love slapping together encounters in single-level adventures from scratch, or reskinning from published adventures, playing off what the party did last session. But unless I'm running a campaign arc that's published and fills in all the major plots and NPCs, I feel overwhelmed by the complexity of managing an appropriately late Tier 2 or high story situation. Once there's more than a few threats, major recurring locations, and NPCs, I start forgetting things at the table, even with my prep, as I'm a very in the moment DM. Any thoughts or tips? Honestly, I'm happy to keep running level 1 to 8, 9-ish campaigns, but I wonder if I'm missing something obvious. Is there a trick to making an expansive situation or story actually narrow to think about when DMing? What about being stuck with a published YAM or heavily railroading the players? First, and I offer this advice quite often, give yourself a break. You're doing fine, right? I mean, it's one thing to like look at it and say, I wonder if that's an area that I want to expand into, but you don't have to say to yourself, I think I'm missing out and I'm worried about my campaigns not being as good. Your campaigns are just fine. Your players are having a good time. You're having a good time. So always, you know, first things first is give yourself a break. If you find yourself being critical of your own work, remember that you're just there to have friends sitting around the table enjoying a time. So if what you find is that by the time you hit end of tier two, things get too complicated, that's totally cool. It's also not unexpected. Right when you cross that tier two envelope, things can get complicated. Some of it is the complexity of characters, the abilities that they have, their ability to kind of manipulate the world around them changes significantly, which means that it's really hard to kind of change the story so that everything isn't just completely solvable by one casting of a particular spell. So tier two overall, and by tier two, we're talking about like level 11 and above in fifth edition games. But yeah, your stories also can get more complicated. One thing that helps me is focusing more on the story that's in front of us. So that's that same idea of like, think about what's going on right around the characters now and who they're interacting with. And you don't have to worry about every single story thread continuing forward until its nice conclusion. Sometimes story threads don't end. Sometimes they just meander off and that's okay. If the players bring them up or you get a feeling for it, well, then you can kind of put them back on your radar and think about what happened with them. And how do you know which ones? You can ask your players, hey, you know, what characters are you interested in seeing progressing forward? You know, which NPCs have you found most interesting? And they give you the list. And then you hear the ones that they don't bring up are the ones you're like, okay, I guess I don't have to worry about them too much. You can still keep them in a list. I've started keeping like a single page list that has current NPCs and previous NPCs on it that has like the name of the NPC and like a one line description. That helps me just keep track. The other thing I'd recommend is that instead of worrying about the plots and the threads and the story bits, just worry about the NPCs, because the NPCs are almost always the ones driving those plots or story threads. What are they up to? And there's almost always an NPC at the center or at the focal point of whatever plot is going on. And if you're keeping track of the NPCs, then you're also keeping track of what those story threads are. So I find that helps me a lot. But then the other one is like, it's okay to just let your game kind of end at the end of tier two and then move back to tier one again. Start at level one. A lot of people do it. A lot of people have been doing that for like 50 years of like, oh yeah, we don't really want to run high level games. We want to run low level games. So that works totally fine too. So Ryan, I hope that helps you out. John says, hi, Mike. Thanks for the great content. I find it easy to get my players excited about published adventures since they might have heard about the adventure and since it's written by professionals. But I find it really hard to get them excited about homebrew campaigns. Do you have any tips on how to get the players excited about homebrew stuff? Yes, I have some tips. So one way to do it is to use a published setting that they're used to. So if they know the setting, if they know Eberron, or they know Spelljammer, or they know Planescape, or they know Dark Sun, or they know Midgard, or they know Numenera, you know, Ninth World for Numenera or whatever, if they know that setting, then it might be just as good as if they knew the adventure. So they might be excited about whatever the new adventure is, but you can also kind of hook them on what the setting is. And I think by focusing on those settings, that you can still capitalize off of the player's knowledge of that setting and what that means for them to run a game. If you say, we're going to run a game in the Sword Coast of the Forgotten Realms, you go, ah, okay. Or we're going to run a game in Baldur's Gate. And they're like, oh, I know Baldur's Gate. I just played Baldur's Gate 3, right? So you can get their attention by focusing on where the setting is going to be. And this leads to my preferred method for running campaigns these days, which is I like to do homebrew adventures and homebrew campaigns in established setting locations. I find that gives me enough freedom to be able to let the adventure go where it's going to go and freedom for the players to drive where the adventure is going to go, but still get the advantage of all of the published material that you get from a good setting. I do wish Wizards of the Coast would do more settings and less adventures, frankly. I don't know why they seem to focus so much on adventures and so little on settings, but that's what seems to be occurring, and it's a bummer. So then the other question is, how do you sell your adventure or your campaign to the players? And that is something something you want to sell? What is going to be exciting to them? What makes this campaign unique among campaigns? What are the things that's really going to drive you to do it? I have to do this right now. I've got to sit down and think about this because my Wednesday game is going to be moving over to City of Arches. I kind of consider City of Arches to be a published setting because it's one that I'm publishing and I have a lot of material for it. I have a lot of artwork for it and I have a lot of stuff and it's been, you know, we're going through editing and I have other people that play tested it. So it's kind of like a published setting, but I want to sell the campaign to the players. I want them to get excited about it. And I want them to talk about what they get. And so I need to bring up those things. And that's where like having a one-page campaign guide that clarifies what's different about this campaign from the other ones that they've played. What's the main hook of the campaign? What's the thing that's driving their characters that's going to drive them to want to play? What are the options that they get available to them to be able to build their characters? All of those things that you can include in like a good one-page campaign guide. I have an article where I talk about building a one-page campaign guide and how you can use that to help sell your campaign. I will link to that in the show notes, but that really helps. So hopefully that gives you some ideas about how to get people, how to get your players excited about homebrew stuff when you're running your games. Rain V says, during our session zero, I usually ask which specific elements my players like about D&D so I can make sure I add a little of whatever they like in the campaign, puzzles, herbalism, etc. But I've recently started asking what they hate about D&D or what drains their energy. It's been very interesting to see what topics come up. PC theft, players being late, interrupting each other, complex lore, metagaming. Are there elements to the game or player behavior that just drains your energy and the fun out of a session for you? I gave you this answer on Patreon too, and so I think I'm going to start with this, which is, boy, I hate interrupts. And by interrupts, I mean like mechanics that break the story, the flow of the story. And this is one of the reasons why like the spell shield bothers me, the spell counterspell bothers me, but and why I've talked a lot about like silvery barbs. And it's not because like these things are powerful or they give, you know, good strength to the characters. It's because they interrupt the flow of the story. And if you run them right, you have to change the flow of the story. And I'm usually like, I'm a pretty improvisational DM and I'm in the middle of my stuff and I'm describing stuff. And just to have somebody say like, wait, and like throw a penalty flag in the middle of the game and then change it. And then I've got to then break out of what I was doing and shift to a new track and then go in another direction. That kind of stuff really bugs me. I get bothered by that. And I talk to my players about it, probably not enough, but I want to. I'd be like, you know, how about we don't do that? Like I kind of have the counterspell arms race conversation. Like I'll make you a deal about counterspell. If you don't counterspell, I won't counterspell. I won't stop you from casting spells. You don't stop the NPCs from casting spells. How does that sound? And actually you get the benefit of that because NPCs have unlimited, and you know, not unlimited, but they don't really care about their spell slots and you do. So that's definitely something that bothers me. But let me, that one I gave you on Patreon. So that's another thing that really bothers me. I don't know. I'm, you know, that's the only thing that comes to mind because I'm just having a ball with my games. And I've managed to kind of work a situation where like some of the things that you mentioned about people either coming late or people missing sessions and stuff like that, my groups have been pretty good about that. We have very regular groups. People tell us when they're not going to be there. I have flexible groups so that people don't have to be there and we can still run the session. I definitely have stuff that works out like that. The whole idea of like player versus player anything, whether it's PC stealing from each other or players attacking each other or even just working cross purposes, I cover in my session zero. I say like, you are all intended to work together to go on adventures to stop whatever's going on. And I'm very clear about that in my session zero. And I talk about like a hard line is player versus player, you know, non-consensual player versus player violence or player versus player interaction, i.e. like you're not allowed to steal from another character unless that character says, sure, you can steal from me. The player always gets to decide whether or not they're going to engage in something like that. Can you have a duel? Sure. Can you have two characters that are arguing with each other? Sure. As long as the players are both cool with it, as long as, you know, that's going on. And that's why we have things like pause for a minute as players. Are we okay with this? And I've had it where like the characters are like at each other's throats. And then I'd say, let's pause for a minute as players. Are you good? And they're like, oh yeah, no, this is great. Like, yeah. I think it could be really fun. Either way this goes, it's going to be really great. So that's, I've managed to build a lot of thing into my game to avoid the things that really bother me. But I think, you know, that one that still bugs me and it happened in the last session was counterspell, where, you know, a player was very excited to be able to drop counterspells on massively powerful NPCs. And it just was interrupting the story left and right. So that's definitely one. Friends, I hope you enjoyed our show today. I had a real blast with this one. What a awesome time we are in for tabletop role-playing games. I'm so excited by the stuff that's hitting my desk. I'm so excited for the games I'm running. I hope you are too. If you enjoyed this show and you want more stuff like this, please consider subscribing to the Sly Flourish newsletter. It's absolutely free to sign up. You get a free adventure generator for signing up, and you get a weekly RPG-related article with all kinds of tips, tricks, tools, and links to all of the other work that I do to help you run your games. You can also support me on Patreon. Your support helps me put on shows like this and do all of the work that I do. You also get access to the awesome Lazy DM community over on Discord, where we all spend all week talking about our games, talking about ways to improve our games, talk about what's going on in the industry. Lots of really great conversation there. And you get access to a whole bunch of different tools to help you run your games. And you can pick up any of my books, including Return of the Lazy Dungeon Master, Forge of Foes, Lazy DM's Companion, the Lazy DM's Workbook, and all my fantastic adventure books on the Sly Flourish bookstore. Links for that are all in the show notes. Thank you so much. Have a great day, and get out there and play an RPG.